Is the world on fire? Hi, everyone. You're listening to a podcast created by students and alumni at the Kroc School of Peace Studies at the University of San Diego. I'm your host, Leah Appleby. Today, we're thrilled to introduce a professional who has dedicated over two decades working in gender, peace, and security. Our guest's extensive experience encompasses a diverse range of crucial areas, including gender mainstreaming, sexual and gender-based violence, preventing and responding to sexual exploitation and abuse, diversity and social inclusion, and advocating for the rights of LGBTQ community. Throughout her career in peacebuilding, she has worked in different sectors of the United Nations, working with a gendered lens and humanitarian work in Niger, Somalia, Haiti, Zambia, Cote d'Ivoire, Burkina Faso, and more. Welcome, Dr. Nadine Prishgweyabal. So our first question that we ask all of our guests is the world on fire?
The world is very much on fire, and it's extremely, if you look at all the different conflicts, natural disasters, that's where we will, more than before, we really need to change the way we operate in this world. We need to change the system. And that's why patriarchy has destroyed the world. And now it's time to advance a new agenda that will be more into restoring our faith in humanity, respecting nature. And I think that that's where feminists all over the world are better equipped today to take this agenda forward. Yes, the world is on fire, but we can't let this make us extremely pessimist and giving up, because patriarchy will never give up. Remember what I said? It's adaptable. It wants to survive. So if we give up, the patriarchy will occupy the space we're gonna give, right? So we need to really remain grounded, find alliances, and move on. We don't have a choice today.
Right. And that's where there is a social movement going on. There's the stirring of people all over the world, especially in like Iran right now, are gathering to make these rights solidified for women all across the world, which is really hopeful. In your article, The Cost of Ignoring Gender and Conflict in the Post-Conflict Situation, A Feminist Perspective, you share a story about an intervention that went wrong in the Tanzanian refugee camp that had designed safe tents for women to go. Can you share a little more about that story?
That's an old example, but a good one. I think that article I wrote, I took that example from the Women's Commission for Refugees, Women and Children. I think it was a report from 1998. And this was exactly the story about a gender blind approach, making so many mistakes in this intervention, probably years before the humanitarian community became gender sensitive. A little bit gender sensitive. Just to summarize, what happened is that humanitarian workers, without consulting the women refugees, they had decided to set up an area that would be specifically dedicated to the women refugees who were single heads of households, right? So they wanted to set up these tents, completely isolate those women, because for them, their assumption was that it would be safe to put all these women together, right? To see the assumption, what problem that will create later. So what the example says is that during the period of time when the system was set up, the number of sexual assaults against women and girls increased. So why? What I wrote in this article is that exactly what happened is that this area, the tents, acted like markers pointing to unaccompanied women. So what does it mean? It means when you said unaccompanied woman, you mean a woman without a man, right? Or a woman without a husband to protect them. And this was sending a strong signal to other men that they were available. So actually, by trying to create a safe area for those women, the humanitarian worker endangered them. And because the women were seen as passive victims or beneficiaries and not actors in their own protection, they were not consulted. It was, once again, we, and I was, when I say we, I mean the humanitarian community, decided for them what was good for them. So you see, from a so-called good intention, we arrive at the situation that do more harm than good.
Thank you for sharing that example. Could you explain and unpack a little bit the term gender blindness for our listeners?
What a gender blind approach is, an approach when you don't differentiate between the different category of people, like refugees or displaced persons. Like, you think you're going to apply the same assistance to the men or the women or the boys and the girls, irrespective of their different needs, different priorities, and also aspirations, right? That was what is a gender blind approach. It's like you treat everybody the same, but we know that war or natural disasters will create different needs, because men and women, and I'm going to, for the sake of the discussion, I'm going to talk about men and women, but I know we should also talk about diverse genders and different category of people. And I'm keeping this in mind, but for the clarity of the discussion, I'm going to talk in broad terms, right? So if you don't pay attention to the needs of, let's say, a pregnant woman will have different needs than a man or a young man or an elderly woman, and you need to better, you know, approach that humanitarian assistance through a proper gender analytical perspective, then you look at the needs of the different category of the population. You will tailor your humanitarian assistance to meet those needs. But if you keep a gender blind approach and you treat everybody the same, irrespective of their needs, you're going to make mistakes, and you're going to reinforce somehow the vulnerabilities of these people going through a war or natural disasters. I don't know if it's clear.
No, that makes sense. Because yes, there's different ways that, I mean, you talk about in your articles how we've reduced women and children as this like innocent victim, rather than realizing the complexity that war brings out, that people can be perpetrators and also be women, and they can be, people can, you know, be actors and have their own agency as a part of all of the conflict and post-conflict of rebuilding. And so that makes sense to have to realize the complexity of everyone's individual experiences in disaster situations. So that's really helpful. And I had never even thought about that or learned about that until talking to you. So thank you for that perspective. You read about your colleague's experience working in the United Nations when she asked to attend the weekly senior management meeting to work on gender. And it was always placed as the last thing to discuss in the agenda as part of a quote, any other business. You have called the UN patriarchal. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and what you mean by that? And then can you explain your reasoning behind?
Oh dear, that's a difficult question. So let me start with this AOB, you know, any other business. What does it mean, any other business? It means that your work is not important enough to be a serious agenda item, right? And again, what do you think is considered as serious? So I'm asking the listeners as well of this podcast, what do you think? What is serious? What is considered serious? Military deployment, police work, what do you think? Rule of law, any political development? This is serious business because it has been, this business has been defined by the men in power, right? But when you work on gender, since it's not treated as a serious issue, as an issue of priority, then you can relegate that to the very bottom of the meeting agenda. And I think these small details have their importance. The way you treat gender, the way you place it on the agenda, the time you will allocate, you know, to discuss gender during this meeting, the attitude of the other meeting participants around the table, are they listening to you when you speak as a gender advisor or not? These are the different pieces of the puzzle, the way I explain it, that show you how gender is not treated as an important issue within the United Nations, and of course with exceptions, but I'm talking globally, international organizations. So that's why I'm saying the UN is a patriarchal organization. And what do I mean by that? So I'm going to use the definition of patriarchy from feminist scholar and mentor Cynthia Enloe. And you know, I'm very fond of her work, and she has really inspired my own research. So I'm extremely grateful I had the opportunity to work with her, exchange, and also participate in talks with her to have a feminist dialogue around deconstructing patriarchy. There are several definitions of patriarchy, but let's use Cynthia Enloe's one. So she's saying something like a society or a group can be defined as patriarchal if it is dependent on three main dynamics. And I hope it will make sense what I'm explaining. So the number one is that you are using in patriarchy masculinity as a privilege, right? And to give you an example around that, look at what's happening at the United Nations. So masculinity as a privilege means that you have mostly men in power. The UN, since its creation, had only men as Secretary General, right? How many? 9, 10 since 1945. And it's just mind-blowing to think that an organization like the UN, with all the beautiful principles that the organization is promoting in the world, the women's rights, the human rights, peace and security, never had a woman Secretary General. And even today, there are some resistance to the calls by different organizations to appoint a woman as Secretary General. So it tells a lot, right? So that's number one. Number two, she says another part of the definition of patriarchy is the marginalization of women. The way we treat, when I say we, I mean international community patriarchal organization, treating women like they lack autonomy, like they are not actors, like they're always dependent on something or somebody. So remember the example I took at the beginning of the interview with the intervention by humanitarian workers not consulting women. This is exactly an example showing this marginalization of women. So you see, in humanitarian and intervention, humanitarian workers will really abide by the rules of patriarchy. And the number three is that you're going to compare, you're going to weight all things deemed to be feminine as of lesser value than those deemed masculine. For instance, when the discussion will turn to topics that really matter, everything that's seen feminine is not a priority, not taken seriously, not important compared to what is masculine. So this is what, in a nutshell, we can call a patriarchal organization. Now, I would say, based on my own experience, being a feminist in such an organization is being in survival mode all the time. You're in the diaper bind situation because you have to tone down your approach to belong. You want to belong, but at the same time, without losing your feminist principles, it's what I call the double bind, and it's exhausting. And you know what? I think the question for the listeners is whether it's even possible to work as a feminist in the UN organization without being co-opted by the system, right?
Right.
That's a question. I'm just putting everything here on the table.
Yeah, that reminds me of, you had a quote that said that 40% of gender experts rejected the label a feminist. So there was this reluctance. How does this reluctance impact the ability to change patriarchal norms within the organization? And what strategies can be employed to encourage a more acceptance of a feminist perspective? Is that even welcome?
Oh, no, I don't think we have acceptance of feminist perspective. Why is that so? Because look at the way gender experts behave. I mean, you are a gender advisor. You have an extremely difficult job, right? You have a pressure to deliver. And we have at the beginning, you know, when the first, and I'm talking now about the UN system and mainly the UN peace operations, the very first jobs post as gender advisor were created following the adoption of Resolution 1325 by the UN Security Council in 2000, right? So it was not even a real job to start with, right? We didn't even have a job description. We had to start from scratch. So you end up with this big momentum after 1325, with really the willingness to do something. The organization is open to move forward to a certain extent. But I think we had a momentum at the beginning that we lost, of course, over the years. But over the years, I think we could see what I call the ghettoization of the work of a gender advisor. Why? Because you work without power, budget, support. You have no authority to implement your mandate, right? So how do you want to really implement this mandate if you don't have the proper support to do it by the top leadership, right? So of course, then you have a pressure to deliver, to justify your very own existence as a gender advisor. Remember what we said at the beginning, it's not treated as a priority, it's not the main item on the agenda. So you need to show results. You have this pressure to show that the work you're doing is important. So what do you do as a gender advisor? And I've done that as well in my time because I had no other choice. The work of a gender advisor, if I can unpack here for the listeners as well, you are assigned in a mission, a peacekeeping mission in the field, like I was in Haiti, for instance. And you have to integrate a gender perspective into the different components of the mission, meaning the work of gender is not going to happen in isolation from the different components of the mission. Let's say you work on elections, you integrate a gender perspective. Same for human rights, same for the police work, same for the political work. If you work on communication, you work on any subject matter within the mission. So what you are supposed to integrate a gender perspective, meaning that you have to build partnership with the different components of the mission. And remember, you have no budget. So you need to make alliances with different offices so they can carry the work. This is extremely, how could I say, it's not a very visible work, right? So what you need to do to show results, you need to turn to the outside of the mission and start to do activities outside of the mission that will be visible, like meeting with women's organization, organizing different activities. So you can see what a gender advisor is doing concretely. But the work outside is one thing. Yes, we need to support women's organizations. We need to build the capacity of different organizations in the country. But the most important, the work of gender mainstreaming, it's really inside the mission. So we don't have that gender blind approach anymore. And it's very difficult and it's not visible. And when you are asked by your leadership, where are the results? It's a long-term approach, gender mainstreaming. You don't have results immediately. So do you understand? Of course you're not, in addition to that difficulty, you're not going to say you're a feminist because you won't be taken seriously. And remember, patriarchy promotes this culture of fear, the fear of not being accepted by the system, the fear of not being supported. So you want to blend. And to do that, you just try to stay away from anything that could be seen as compromising your work within the patriarchal system. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No, that makes sense. It's the belief that women and genderqueer individuals are like this extra added bonus rather than inherently having their own value that needs to be integrated in the solutions that are being made. So it's kind of interesting that you're having to like infiltrate all these little side divisions and different sectors in order to make gender mainstreaming happen. That sounds exhausting.
It is exhausting, I can tell you.
The tactic of delaying gender-related initiatives is discussed as a patriarchal strategy. Can you share more from your experience about the language of later, and there is still a long way to go in the international community? Can you share examples where procrastination has been particularly detrimental and how advocates for gender equality overcome this hurdle to ensure timely and effective integration of gender perspective?
Yes, it's an important discussion because it's all about language. And I'm really, my work is mainly about uncovering the patriarchal lies and the patriarchal truth. And for that, you need to really pay attention to language. And I'm really obsessed with language because that's how you frame people. That's how you frame situations. Remember what I said at the beginning? When you talk about women and children, then you put them in this category of, you put the women in the category of victims somehow. You keep them in the private realm, like they are caretaker and caregiver mainly, and not peacemakers, you see, or peace negotiator. So that's why you have to pay attention to the tricks that patriarchy plays. And that's exactly what you said. When each time you are told that, we can't work on gender issues now, we don't have the time, it's better we do it later. That's just later. It's a way for patriarchal organizations to gain time, you know, but it means that it will never happen. It's a strategy to not deal with the problem. Let me explain a little bit this. You know, Cynthia and Luke keep saying, later is a patriarchal time zone. And I like this quote because it's exactly what it is. And later will be too late. Why? Because, you know, let's say you have an emergency, a humanitarian emergency, and humanitarian workers will tell you, but we don't have time to do this gender work. You know, we have an emergency here. So we do it later. Don't worry. When the war is over, or they can tell you when the hurricane is gone, when a new constitution is drafted, what else? Oh, when combatants will be disarmed, we can do it later. But later will be too late. One, why? Because you will have, if you lose the momentum, then later, what does it mean? Later, the men who were combatant in the war, they will become the new peacemakers, right? So women will be marginalized. Women will be sidelined. It will be too late to bring them. So that's why you need to involve the woman at the very early stage of any kind of emergency, any kind of humanitarian or peace operations, to ensure that they have a voice in the process. And for instance, if I take the example when you're mentioning, you know, there is still a long way to go. It's in the same kind of mindset. So later, it's to gain time, okay? But when you are told there is still a long way to go, let's say, gender equality is important. Oh, but there is still a long way to go. Women's rights are key, but you know, we haven't reached a complete enjoyment of women's rights because it's complicated. There's a long way to go. So what is this long way to go rhetoric? Is to reassure people and to that the organization is making progress, right? But yeah, we're working on it. We're working on gender equality, but it takes time to see results. And I've seen time and again the UN doing that with donors. You know, be patient. You're going to get some result. You know, donors, they put money on some activities. They're asking too many questions about what are you doing for gender equality. So you want them to keep them waiting, because sometimes you haven't made that many progresses, right? So that's another trick. And I think if you want to understand with another example, a concrete example, let's say Haiti, again, earthquake in 2010, women and girls were at risk of violence, mainly sexual violence, in the camps that were set up for the people who had been left homeless, right? Why? Because these camps were not organized. They were not organized to separate the girls from, let's say, the men. Everybody was living in the same space. And the pattern was not even new, because 6 years earlier, after a hurricane, and I was there, there was a hurricane in Haiti, and the girls and the teenagers were victims of violence in the shelter because they were living in the same space as men. So listen, because humanitarian workers were in a hurry to relocate the people victim of natural disaster, they didn't pay attention to the gender dynamics at play. Who was the most at risk and why? And how can you organize shelters so that they'll be safe for women and girls? So we were told, oh, no, this could be done later, after the first emergency phase is over, after people have found a place and have a place to stay, have a roof above their head. And, you know, it takes an understanding of the gender dynamics in that environment, because then you understand the different vulnerabilities of individuals, the different needs. You see the reality as it is, not as the humanitarian workers would like them to see it. You know, so you organize your space, you organize your humanitarian relief in a way that will not expose specific groups to more harm and danger. That's why I'm saying that what I call patriarchy is a master in what I call the art of procrastination. You don't identify problems, you don't deal with it, but then later you're going to pay the price for that, for not identifying these problems early enough in the process.
It's more simple that way to just see people and be like, oh, it's just a body, put them in a tent and like, we're going to rush through it. And so to like stop for a second and slow down and like, notice the complexities and the differences between people does take time, but then at what cost is the, you know, on these individuals who are harmed in those situations where people just rushed on? It does that, like, pokes holes in the effectiveness and like the ethical choices of what these humanitarian aid workers are doing, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. And then you do more harm than good in the end, yeah. You see? So that's why, and it's not more work. I mean, you see, the problem we have when we explain what a gender perspective is that people think, oh, it's going to be an additional burden. It's going to be more work and we don't have the time. It's just a mindset, is to see the world through gender lenses, to acknowledge that different people have different experience of war and natural disaster. They have different vulnerabilities, but also coping mechanisms. And you need to engage them in the process of defining the humanitarian assistance, because they have to be actors of their own protection, for instance, right? It's in terms of ownership, I think it's key.
Your analysis emphasizes the need to ask root questions and challenge deep-seated structures. In practical terms, how can individuals within patriarchal institutions effectively bring about change without compromising their job or work relationships?
It's exactly when you are labeled as a radical feminist. You're just like, yeah, I'm a radical feminist. What does it mean, asking radical questions? It means that you ask root questions, because radical comes from the Latin word root, meaning you want to go deep into the understanding of things and situations. You want to deconstruct system of abuse and oppression and discrimination, right? So for individuals to effectively bring about change without compromising your job situation, I don't think if it's even possible. But what can I say is that you have to make inequalities visible. I think it's key. If you remember what we said, you don't acknowledge problems, you don't see problems, then you don't have to solve it, to solve them, right? So if you start collecting sex and age and disability disaggregated data, let's say, you collect data so you know exactly, you have the composition of your refugee population or displaced persons, you know exactly where the problem is. Or where the problem are. And then it's using those data, you'll be able to identify the needs and the problem, and then you'll be able to fix them, bring solution to fix them, right? But you need to make situation visible, because no data, very often you don't see exactly the problems, right? So what I would recommend for individuals these days who are brave enough, who want to challenge patriarchal institution, but not compromising their working relations, it's to really pay attention to details, take a lot of notes, and again, pay attention to language, and use everything that you have within the system that has been approved by the organization, for instance, existing tools, guidance, policies, frameworks. Look, the Women, Peace and Security agenda built on Resolution 1325 has been translated in several languages in the world and is used today by grassroots activists for their own advocacy, right? So even if that resolution is not legally binding, you can use it as an instrument to push for the promotion of women's rights, protection issues, to push for bringing more women to the peace table, for instance. So that's what you have to be clever and use what the system gives you. Secondly, I think also you an insider working in a patriarchal environment, you should share information with outsiders so they can help you analyze it with the distance you might not have. So you find allies in your feminist perspective. And something that will be extremely relevant is that I think you have to be clear about how long you can sustain your efforts in a patriarchal system before it breaks you. And this is for me a very, very serious issue, because you need to ask yourself, is it worth it? Before losing your health, your balance, or your mental health, right? And I can add something also. I would ask also listeners or any young people who plan to work for the UN or any patriarchal organizations, be careful, because we talk a lot about how patriarchy is an oppressive system. And I don't think we talk enough about how patriarchy is also rewarding and protecting people who are playing by the rules of patriarchy, right? So patriarchy is adaptable, can develop new strategies to stay alive, to hang on to power. Loyalty, I find, is a strong key word in the patriarchal world. And patriarchy will divide people, putting them against each other. So it's a complicated system that's very clever to be able to survive in any circumstances. So to finish on your question, I would say I would tap into the work of the spiritual leader Eckhart Tolle, Eckhart Tolle in his book, The Power of Now, is explaining that when you're facing a difficult situation, you have three options. You can either accept it, try to change it if it's possible, or leave it. And he said, he concludes by saying, all else is madness. And I think, which brings me to my point, that resisting patriarchy within the system itself is not possible, because you risk to be marginalized, ostracized, victim of abuse of power, and ended up in a burnout. And there are so many feminists in this system that ended up in burnout, and it takes years to recover. So again, ask yourself the question, is it worth it?
That reminds me of Audre Lorde's, "The master's tool will never dismantle the master's house." Of, yeah, that, I mean, to choose yourself after all of that is very brave, especially with the mind games and how much patriarchy is trying to continue to dominate and win. And I'm also thinking of the language of, like, if you just work hard enough and play along, like, things will all come together. But not being sucked into that rhetoric and that, I mean, even that, like, philosophy of work, but to be, I don't know, resisting. That's, I mean, that's, it's just complex. And
totally. And you know what? To jump on what you said, I like this quote by Audre Lorde. The master's tool will never dismantle the master's house. What does it mean? It means that the UN system has been defined, and many systems anyway, by the according to the masculine norm of reference, right? So the system is asking women or any individual who don't really fit the profile, I would say, to adjust to the dominant patriarchal culture, right? So it means that you adjust to the culture, you adjust to the system in place in terms of behavior, in terms of attitude and language, right? So if I think what Audre Lorde is saying is that we can't change a system like that if we do not challenge it. We do not challenge the existing status quo. So I think women in particular and feminists need to define their own space within that system, within their own references. But again, it's very difficult. Why? Because we remember this discussion. I keep saying that we are trying, when you work as a feminist within the system, you're trying to be taken seriously. So you will, you know, you to be taken seriously, you have to abide by existing rules, institutional rules and regulations as defined by the men in power, right? If you want to be taken seriously, the men in power and the women also who play by the boys' rules and have been co-opted by the system, they define what is important, what is acceptable, and what is serious. That's why we have a very limited, I would say, very limited room for maneuvering within that system.
Where do you see gender rights and the, you know, feminist movement? Where have we come from in the past decade, and where do you think we're going? Has there been much change in the last 10 years?
You see, I think there have been changes, and I look at what's happening in different countries. I mean, we need to really pay attention to what's happening at the level of the grassroots activism, right? Because that's where the real people are. They're fighting for their rights, they're fighting for their survival, they're fighting for their land. And we probably have to support them. When I say we, again, talking about international community, humanitarian community, I think we need to tell the stories of those women and men fighting for their rights. And very often, you know, we don't really take into consideration what they go through. I mean, look at all these activists who are killed just for, you know, defending the rights of people or the environment. And that's that's what is serious issue, you know, the way these activists define what is important or not. And that's that. I think that was, we need to be more grassroots oriented. All these international organizations with so many people who think they know what the needs are, who are, you know, taking decisions not based on the reality on the ground. That's not the future. And you know what? What makes me think as well, the more we're going to pay attention to details, the more we're going to document everything happening on the ground, document the stories of all the brave men and women fighting for their rights, the more we're going to do that, maybe the more opportunities we're going to get to break patriarchy. Because, you know, patriarchy can't survive on details. It can't survive. Why? Because details will, remember what I said, details will reveal how it operates. The scrutiny reveals the truth, right? So once problems have been identified, it will be more difficult to ignore them. So the more we overwhelm patriarchy with details, with stories, the more we're going to also share information with people who have no idea what's happening in different countries, because they believe the rhetoric of what I would say the formal voice in international institutions. But I think the more we're going to awaken the world with what's happening on the ground, the more success we might get in really taking patriarchy down. Or maybe I'm too, I don't know, maybe I'm too optimistic, or but that said, you need to tell the truth. You need to document what's happening on the ground.
I appreciate you talking to us today. I love how you focus on language, and I feel like you are a practitioner, like a philosopher, practicing what you believe, and it's just very inspiring. So thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to today's episode with Dr. Nadine. Before you go, we want to hear from you. Share your questions, stories, or ideas on the fires you see in the world today. Contact us on Instagram at crocschool or via email at istheworldonfire@gmail.com. And let us know, what is your fire? Today's episode was produced by myself, Leah Appleby, Hallie Schilling, and Thomas Oliver, with special help from Scott Lendergan and Ryan Murphy. It was edited by Jim O'Connell and includes original music by Victor Daniel Castro Escobar. Promotion is made possible by Kevin Dobbins, Tony Campos, and Andrew Byros. Tune in next time.